We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. Your hosts are Michael McNamara and me, Ryan Schwan. It's all Pelicans, all the time.
Welcome to the show. The Pelicans have just completed an amazing, astounding, staggering 2-2 week, Michael. And the vibe I get from the interwebs is all sunshine and roses. Are you in the sunshine and roses camp?
They went 2-2. Anthony Davis had some high impact games, and Ish Smith is playing like an all-star. I don't know how you could not be excited. Tyreek's coming back. We beat a team that many considered at the beginning of the year the co-favorite to win the title. It's all good from here. I'm pumped.
You're pumped. So so the team is now 3-11. But I've got to say, like the outpouring of happiness after these last two games, which you know it's at home versus San Antonio and Phoenix. So both neither of those are bad teams, and obviously San Antonio is a very good team. Is this a real? They're coming back. They're going to be able to start chaining some wins together. Or should we be, you know, more along the lines of it's just an aberration?
Yeah,
to be quite honest, like the worst teams in the league, they end up with records that have similar winning percentages of 3-11.
Yeah, and I mean some of those games, you know, even if Philly only wins 13 games this year, they're going to beat 13 teams that are considered better than them. Mm-hmm. And on those nights, their fans will probably say, look at our potential, yada, yada. Yeah, no, I get the other side. I think that it's a combination of things where there has been signs leading up to this as well. I mean, you know, we talked about it on the last podcast. We had saw that their defense was really good for 24 out of 48 minutes, specifically the first half, for a couple of games in a row. And we're starting to see signs that Ryan Anderson is back as good, maybe even better than ever, combined with Anthony Davis starting to play with some of the passion, some of the intensity that we've wanted to see all year, and putting up the stats to go with it, and the fact that, you know, to be honest, the point guards have been terrible this year, but one, a surprising one at that, but one is starting to finally break through a little bit. And when you combine that with the fact that Tyreek could be back as soon as the next game, I think it's a combination of things, not just the wins in a vacuum that have people excited.
Yeah. So let's just talk about him in particular, because I know people are getting a little over the top about the guy, but Ish Smith, you know, early on he was putting up some decent numbers and people were super excited about it. And the whole time you were like, no, come on, anybody can put up 7 or 8 assists when they have the ball in their hands for 30-something minutes in this kind of offense. Are you past that point with Ish Smith now? If somebody came to you and told you, say, Norris Cole has been traded, and you now have to roll with 4 guards, and those guards are Gordon, Holiday, Evans, and Ish Smith, are you at all upset by that? Are you worried about that? Is Ish Smith not that kind of quality, or do you think he's even better than that quality?
I mean, the first question I would ask is, what did I get for Cole? But just assuming that, like, he's out, I do think it's a downgrade overall. I don't get into 2 games making me change my opinion. It's going to take a lot more than that. I do like what I've seen. I like the way he plays. I like the way he probes. What I think I like the best about him is the pressure he takes off of Jrue Holiday. You know, Jrue Holiday's scoring has still been a problem this year, but as we've seen, and it's indicative of the past, when you put another point guard on the floor with Jrue Holiday, his turnovers plummet, and that helps the team a lot. So I'm not ready to say that, you know, I saw a post today where people were asking, well, what do we do with Norris Cole now? I mean, it's funny what happens in just a couple of games. I mean, a week ago, people were asking, what could we get for Ryan Anderson in a trade? Today, people are asking me if we'll be able to keep him. You know, we're always so reactive to the last couple of things. I'm not going to make the mistake of doing that with Smith, but what I will say is they, you know, he was a huge part of these 2 wins, and he was a big part of what kept them in it in the Oklahoma City game, and I'm not as afraid now if a guy, you know, one guy goes down, not 2 or 3, but if one guy goes down and he has to play 10 to 15 minutes, I'm not as worried now as I would have been, say, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm almost to the point where, and I'm not saying that there should be any consideration to trade Norris Cole or any sort of backup guard. Like, that's not at all what I'm thinking, but Cole is on a 1-year deal. And just based on what I've seen, if Norris Cole at the end of this year ends up getting a deal and it doesn't seem advantageous to the team to try to, you know, convince him to stay for a similar deal, and he walks, I mean, you're going to be able to get Ish Smith and keep him on this team for some decent amount of money. That wouldn't shock me if that happened. Like, Ish Smith has enough quality that I don't think he's going to be a major negative to this team when he plays. So
yeah, and I mean, this is what I said before the season, is you could pick up a minimum level point guard. You know, all teams do it. Mo Williams, I think, has the 2nd or 3rd highest true shooting percentage for a point guard in the NBA this year. Obviously, yeah. Steph Curry's 1, but I think I'm 99% sure, I looked this up today, numbers 2 and 3 are Ramon Sessions and Mo Williams. Hmm. Like, there's just plenty of these mid-tier guys that you could get in or around the minimum salary, you know, that'll all have some level of effectiveness. And I don't want to take anything away from Ish Smith, but I'm also, I mean, I will never make any kind of judgment on 2 games. I still think he has a lot of the limitations that he had in those games where we were having trouble getting offense. People were playing at him. I think that basically, to me, the thing with him and Cole is I don't think there's a universal answer. I would say, tell me the other 4 guys on the court, and I will tell you which guard I would rather have. Because if it's low usage guys, I want Norris Cole to create his own offense and have a little bit of range. But if I have, let's say, Eric Gordon, Drew Holiday, Ryan Anderson, and Anthony Davis out there, give me Ish Smith. I would prefer him in that situation. I think he is a very good player when he's surrounded by other players and he's the fourth or fifth option.
And you have brought up my next point. So, you know, we started off this season, and you know, I'm sure there's probably people listening to this podcast who are just like, you guys suck. You hated Ish Smith. You guys think Alonzo G was for the dogs. Like, there are players who were playing for this team at the beginning of this year who were like, that guy looks terrible. He's awful. Oh, God. There's nothing good on this team. How much, like, we're now seeing Ish Smith suddenly being a decent player. We're suddenly seeing Alonzo G be a decent player. How much of that is just the fact that if you take a role-playing NBA player and actually start surrounding him with good players, like what they all they have to do is their role, suddenly they seem fine. Like Dante Cunningham, I think, could get back to where he was last year, where we thought he was just a nice role player. But this, I mean, if you took a look at the last two games, when they rolled out that starting lineup, it was almost the starting lineup we expected. It's Omer Asik, Davis, Alonzo G, Gordon, Drew Holiday the last couple of games. And so the only one surprised there would be, you know, when we were looking at the beginning of the season, was G. And he'd be replaced with Quincy Pondexter, who in some respects he's a better offensive player. He may not be a better defensive player. So they're getting close to the team we wanted. This is a team that's able to have those guys off the bench instead of Cole being our first point guard. It's Ish Smith. It's Ryan Anderson coming off the bench and being a flamethrower like we always hoped. And now it's just starting to find those other guys off the bench. And Tyreke Evans coming back is going to help there. Like, suddenly, is it shocking to you that Alonzo G is playing much better now?
No, I mean, this is exactly what role players are. You think James Jones has a job anywhere else? Like, James Jones follows LeBron around.
Right.
Not, you know, because he's a smart man and he knows he probably cannot play anywhere else in the league. You know, you see situations like that all the time where there's these role players. I mean, remember, I clearly remember when Mike Miller went to Memphis. Like, that was a big story. That was a front page of ESPN. That was all over my Twitter line story. Mike Miller is going to Memphis. Like, people think Mike Miller's still a player, but, you know, he is because LeBron made him look that way. That's, you know, role players are completely dependent on that, and you're right. We just had every single guy moved up two, sometimes three pegs. I mean, Eric Gordon should not be taking 16 shots a game. You know, his numbers aren't great this year. I mean, luckily he's taking a lot of threes, so he's somewhat efficient, but he's not hitting at a high level. But that's because he's been asked to be the second or third, on some days even the first option when AD's hurt. And he's more of a, you want him taking probably the fourth or fifth most shots on your team type of guy. So, yeah, I mean, it's clear, like I said on a pod a couple of weeks ago, we could talk about all these things, but it's clear as day that the issues are the injuries and really nothing other than that. And now we start to see guys going into their right role. We don't see Ish, DC, and Gee on the court anymore together. We see them scattered a little bit more, and now they could all have their own little impact. So, yeah, I mean, the guys are not good players, but they have the skill sets and the abilities to look decent when they're paired with the right guy. I mean, yeah, Ish got a lot of props after that Phoenix game. I think Alonzo G might have been as important, if not more important, when you consider his impact on both sides of the ball.
Yeah, defensively he was pretty impressive, and we had seen flashes of him being able to do that before, but part of it is he's backed up in general by better players. Like, when he runs a screen and roll, if he's got, you know, Omer out there for whatever minutes Omer's playing these days, they have to hesitate just for a second when they see Omer, which gives him just enough time to catch back up and get in the picture. NBA defense is a matter of half seconds and seconds, and if you can make them, you know, sputter for that much time, you can get back in front of them. And it just feels like they're able to buy those little half seconds a little better as these players come back. You brought it up. Tyreek Evans. He's coming up in this next Phoenix game. We get to rematch with Phoenix, and I'm actually looking forward to it because as annoying as the free throws were in that Phoenix game, I had fun watching that game more than I had fun with the San Antonio game. I also had fun with the Oklahoma City game. Just watching those games just had a different feel to me. I enjoyed the games. So I'm looking forward to this rematch in Phoenix. Tyreek Evans is coming back. You look at this roster. I'm going to assume he's probably in his first game back going to play half the game. I think that's about right, 24 minutes?
Yeah, I'm thinking around 20 to 25, closer to the 25. Yeah, right around there.
Okay, so where do those minutes come from? Do you think they're coming from Ish Smith? Do you think Omer Asik's going to have to just sit on the bench the whole game? Like, maybe he gets 2 minutes at center, and then he gets to sit on the bench the rest of the time while Tyreek Evans plays center? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at that box score, I think the first thing you do is you take away Babbitt and Tony Douglas's 13 minutes. So that's 13 right there. Although Guy was important, I don't think he plays 38. Ideally, I don't think you have Gordon playing 39 or Smith 30. So you're looking at stealing maybe 3 minutes from each of those guys and completely ridding yourself of Babbitt and Douglas. Maybe situationally you might use Babbitt here or there, but for the most part, his eight minutes and three fouls, you could take that away and somehow survive. So, yeah, I mean, it's huge upgrades there. And, you know, I know people keep talking about the Kobe assists and how much Davis and maybe even Ryan Anderson is going to benefit from Tyreek Evans, but I still firmly believe that the biggest beneficiary will be Drew. And we talk about all this Ish Smith stuff. I really enjoy a good debate, and I think that the thing I pride myself in a debate is I like when everybody's going one way to be able to find an argument for the other way, even if I don't believe it. I could not make an argument right now for Drew Holiday being superior to Ish Smith in any way this season, and that's the most insane thing that I've ever said, at least where I would have been a month ago. Saying that just feels so weird. But as good as Ish Smith has been, and as we've seen him get better as he's been more comfortable with the season, what the heck is going on with Drew Holiday? And do you expect him to break out of a funk? Because right now he's basically playing like an average backup would.
Yeah, I expect him to break out of it at some point. I really do. I still feel like he's pressing. I don't get that mentality. I really don't, because let's be 100% honest. The San Antonio Spurs last year and the year before played Tony Parker 28 minutes a game. He was a starter. He had a huge impact on those games the past two seasons. Maybe not so much this year. We saw what Tony Parker has devolved into this week. But 28 minutes a game, and he had a big impact. And Drew Holiday is like, feels like he's got some sort of mental thing going on. He's like, I only can play 25 minutes. I got to do everything I possibly can. And he's so frantic, and he makes bad decisions, and he's not in the flow ever. And it does not feel right at all when he's out there. I will say, and this doesn't at all counter the fact that Ish Smith can get penetration anytime he wants to. But Drew Holiday is a vastly superior option when you're doing this particular Pelicans defense. because they any sort of guard or wing pick and rolls that other teams run, they freely switch it. And we have seen multiple teams, especially Atlanta, did this to our just they shredded us doing it. They would just run those side pick and rolls with wings and get Ish Smith on some sort of big guy, and that would just destroy our defense. And Drew Holiday can handle that a whole lot more than Ish is. That's the only thing I can say, because Ish Smith has been clearly the superior offensive player, and clearly because just the way he gets the ball and pushes as hard as he can, and he gets up the court really fast, he puts so much pressure on the other team that it's not just the fact that he gets to the rim or he's been clever with the ball in space or he's found the open man, it's just he is keeping them on their heels all the time, and that helps so much when it comes to freeing up other guys' shots.
Yeah, I think, and another thing that we've learned more to date that some other people are blaming for some of Holiday's woes is that he's really not able to practice. I mean, I know, you know, he's not practicing every day. He's not practicing entire practices, even on the days that he practices. I mean, he's on a, people think of the minutes restriction and the back-to-back restriction, but he's also on a practice restriction. I think I'll be a little bit more comfortable evaluating him once all the restrictions are pulled off and we get a couple more, you know, a couple more weeks to see him. But, I mean, again, the one thing that is true with Ish playing more by his side the last couple of games, the turnovers have reduced drastically. I put up a tweet a couple of days ago. I think at the time the stat was that when he's on the floor with Ish Smith, he only turns the ball over once every 13 minutes. When he's on the floor without another point guard, it's something like once every 7.5 minutes. I mean, it's pretty drastic, and it's really clear after we've seen him for a couple years up close that he's not a traditional point guard. You don't want to put him on the floor, you know, without another point guard. I would love another point guard on the floor with him at almost all times. So I think Tyree coming back, I think adding Cole to the equation. I think we saw a lot of three-guard sets. People are saying which one plays Ish or Cole. I think with as many three-guard sets as we have, I think the answer is all of the above. I think that you're going to see three-guard sets, and especially if you consider Quincy Pondexter a guard, which I think you and I both tend to think of him more as a two.
He's a small wing.
Yeah, so if you consider that and you're talking about those six guys now, all as guards and slash small wings, I think you see three of them on the court 38 out of the 48 minutes a game. I think you're going to see really heavy guard rotations. We saw it against San Antonio and a little bit against Phoenix when they had Ish, Eric Gordon, and Drew Holiday on the court all at the same time. And the drive and kick potential was just insane. And it's no wonder that Ryan Anderson is eating like a madman too. I think we're going to see even more of it.
Yeah. That during crunch time, at least until Holiday fouled out, it was Gordon, Drew, and Ish Smith with Anderson and Davis. And it's a lot of fun to watch. And with Davis in that particular game and kind of the San Antonio game, he just seemed to have a lot more energy and to be really, really going after the ball on like for rebounds. That's a pretty deadly team to watch when they're all doing that. And so I got to ask you that. Like, this is what I don't understand about Anthony Davis, and he's been banged up here and there. But do you have any question in your mind that the Anthony Davis we saw in San Antonio against San Antonio and against Phoenix was a vastly different player than we'd seen in almost any other game this season so far?
Different in what way? I just want to make sure I'm clear before I answer it.
Energy. Just how hard he was going all game long.
I mean, those rebounds, and sometimes it got him into trouble. I remember the offensive rebound where he basically fought Alonzo Gee for it, and it cost us a possession. But in general, the way he went after rebounds, that alone, I hadn't seen him anything like that this year. I mean, people remember the block shot on Aldridge and throwing it off his knee and him getting the crowd all hype and stuff like that. But, I mean, when things are going well, almost all players, except for Al-Farouq Aminu and Omer Asik, show emotion. So, I mean, people are always like, we lost tonight because we didn't show any emotion. I tend to think it's the other way around. I tend to think that when things go well, players are more chatty and talkative and pumped up and get in with the crowd. And when things go bad, they don't. So I actually think it's the reverse cause and effect. So I don't look at that as much. I think that's all lazy fan narrative and not true. What I do look at is the way that they attack certain things on the court and the way he attacked rebounds in those games. Like, I haven't seen that guy all year, and I could sit here and bitch and moan about the fact that I haven't seen that guy all year. I really don't care. I'm just happy we have him now. I don't need an explanation for why we didn't have him before. But with that guy, that was the guy I thought we were getting since game one, and with that guy, they could be in any game. You know, they might not win every game, obviously, but I think with that guy, even with a demolished supporting staff, I think they could be in any game.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know. In some respects, it almost feels like... So, I have a hard time putting this into words. In some respects, I almost feel like Anthony Davis is a social player. Like, I think he kicked ass so much in college because he had a team with a bunch of guys that he got along with really well, and they were all on the same page and in the same corner. And sure, maybe the coach helped get that there. Maybe like Darius Miller helped get that there. Like, he felt like he had guys with the same mentality and that he enjoyed playing with, and that he was just like rocking it out there and having a good time. And it almost feels like he struggled at the beginning of this year to make those connections with people that were available to play. Like, I don't feel like he has that connection with a couple of the players that are on this team long-term, and that's okay. He doesn't have to have it with all of them, but it felt like maybe the guys he had that connection with the most weren't available on the floor, and now he's kind of formed it with Ish Smith, and he's always kind of had it with Anderson. You can see there's like always been like a back and forth between them. But I kind of wonder, like, having those guys on the floor with him, does that change his mentality dramatically? Do you think that could be something, or am I just like grasping at straws and trying to play the psychologist at home when I really have no clue what I'm talking about?
I mean, we're both guessing, but from the stuff that, you know, we've been told by people who are in the locker rooms and who see things and go to the games and observe the practices, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it seems like the only guy that he really has a strong relationship with, which is kind of strange, is Alonzo Gui. And yeah, not many or any of the long-term guys that we might expect. But and then the other thing we have to factor in is he probably had that. It did seem like he had that relationship with Monty. And even though I'm sure Gentry has done his best to warm up with him, you know, these are a bunch of new guys. I mean, on the coaching staff, he's probably still close with Kevin Hansen, but he's still learning to trust all of these coaches. And so, yeah, I mean, I could see that as part of it. The other part of me says, you know, we could give him a bunch of excuses. I still would have preferred that, you know, he just took the bull by the horn rather than did what we saw in the first couple of games. But, you know, whatever it takes for him to get there, it seems like, you know, it's taken him a while to get there as a leader, but he's getting there now. And if really all we had to do in the grand scheme of things was to suffer 12, 14, 15 games, however long it was, for a light bulb to have gone on in him and we see this guy the rest of the time, I really don't care. It's well worth it. The guy I want to talk about is, man, I mean, I think that we we played the what-if optimistic side for Ryan Anderson coming into this year. And, you know, I've had my theories since last year when looking at the home-road splits of, well, we've seen a version of Ryan Anderson that could be good, and maybe Urban could put him in position defensively and yada, yada, yada. I don't know if I even expected what we saw this week from Ryan Anderson. And, you know, it's all levels. The three-point shot is good. It's right about where he is in his career average, but the step backs, the post-ups, you know, just the overall intensity that he's playing with and not being absolutely terrible on the defensive end. So far, to me, this season, he's exceeded my expectations or my hopes, you know, as far as being as optimistic as I could have been. What do you feel about what you've seen from Ryan Anderson this year, and what do you think the potential is for the year as a whole for him?
Well, I think I could put that into a nutshell for you with one simple explanation. There is no shot I have a stronger physical aversion to than a post-up that turns into a turnaround fadeaway jumper from about 18 feet. Because now you've thrown yourself off balance to create the contact necessary to create the space. Then you're turning around, so you're even more off balance, and then you're jumping away from the basket, so taking a lot of the force from your legs away from the shot. I hate that. I swear every time I see it, I think I have a physical reaction to whenever any player takes it. And if it's the other team, I giggle like an idiot. When Ryan Anderson does it right now, I go, okay.
Yeah, he's approaching that Steph Curry territory. Not in all his shots, but in that shot of, that's a bad shot for anybody else.
It's ridiculous.
That's a good shot for Ryan Anderson. I mean, it's what he works at. He's not the most athletic guy in the world. But really, what's the difference between that and the mid-post Michael Jordan fade? I mean, how many times a game did we see Michael Jordan in his prime take that 18-foot mid-range fadeaway, and that shot would get killed nowadays as far as the type of shot you want to take. But that was Jordan's bread and butter. But you know what? He made it. And at times it set up other things when he would pump fake and go around or get fouled or whatever. I mean, the level at which he's making that, at which he's operating in the post, it might just be one of those things where, yeah, in a vacuum, that isn't a good shot, but it's a quality shot. For that guy, I mean, at the rates that he's hitting it, I don't mind it at all. I'm actually, the Ryan Anderson shot that I get most worried about is the wide open three. I feel like he almost never makes that. Like, he's too open. That's the one where I'm like, all right, I hope somebody's around to rebound. I just almost never expect the Ryan Anderson wide open three to go in. But anything else, I mean, the way he's playing now and the fact that when him and Anthony Davis are on the court together, at least what we've seen recently defensively, it is not a dumpster fire. I mean, I think over the last couple of games, they have something like a defensive rating of 93.4 or something like that. Again, small sample size, but even just eye test, I am not seeing a dumpster fire out there. I'm starting to see what Ehrman was preaching in Summer League, where he talked about, we're not going to do fancy things with the defense. We're just going to ask for multiple efforts from guys. And I think we're starting to see that. I think we're starting to see multiple efforts on a possession. I got to give Eric Gordon props. He's trying like crazy out there as well, giving multiple efforts on plays. But if Ryan Anderson and Anthony Davis can be even average defensively, the way that they are playing offensively, and AD hasn't even hit his stride yet, their potential offensively, I mean, that could be the most devastating 4-5 combo in the league, again, if they could be just average defensively, and lately they have been.
Yep. It is a lot of fun watching those two work on the same floor, because like the whole time Anderson is running those side pick and rolls with guys, Davis is just lurking on the other side. And if you watch, if you can keep your eyes off of Anderson, which is hard because the ball goes up so fast when he's running those side pick and rolls, they cannot leave Davis. They don't leave Davis because almost every team has come in now with a scouting report that says, don't leave Davis alone by himself. And if he gets the ball, send two people or three people. Phoenix triple teamed Ryan Anderson in that game. Like, he got to the point where they were going after him that way, but like every scouting report is Davis can be forced into mistakes. Send a second guy at him as soon as he's got the ball if he tries to dribble it, and you can get some mistakes out of him. But he's also got that gravity. You cannot leave him alone because he's going to slip to the basket. And on a lot of these past few games, like, he's not only that kind of gravity, but he's getting into incredible, incredible offensive rebounding position. That Phoenix game, I counted on my little notepad. I was taking notes as I was watching the game. I counted 9 separate times where he had sealed his man off completely from the basket, and somebody on the Pelicans made the shot. But Davis was probably like in 70% rebounding territory. He was going to get that ball when it came off the rim, unless it went really high, 70% of the time, because he had just sealed whoever he was battling completely. He could have had like a monster offensive rebounding game if the Pelicans weren't catching fire in that game.
And just so people know, what's the name of your eBay store that they could buy your game used notepads off of?
It's all on my Kindle. So,
that's too bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. I mean, he's been terrific, and of course, with anything like that, you know, you're gonna have some things that aren't ideal as well. I put up a piece today, and partly because Ryan Anderson is playing so well, but partly for other reasons. When the Pelicans' 4 big men are all healthy and play the entire game, you're looking at about 18 or 19 minutes a game for the combination of Alexei Ajinsa and Omer Asik. 18, 19 minutes a game for two guys that they're paying about $60 million over the next 4 years. I mean, you know, I know the season's young, and I know they still might be used in spots here or there, but you're paying guys, even when the cap jumps, you're going to be paying them 11 to 14% of the cap, and they're playing about 8% of total minutes. I mean, it's getting hard to kind of stomach those contracts where If all you needed was 18 minutes a game, 19 minutes a game, keep the flexibility for future years, lose those guys for quote-unquote nothing, and, you know, go out and get a couple of mid-level guys or minimum contract guys, hope to find the next Hassan Whiteside or a poor man's version or the next Gustavo Ayon or whatever. It's just getting harder and harder for me to stomach those contracts, not necessarily for the players they are, but for how it looks like they're going to be used. I mean, they're getting 18, 19 minutes a game, and this is why we still have 3 6'6" or shorter guys who are going to be in the rotation out. There's a possibility even more minutes get taken from them. What is your feeling on, you know, that whole situation in total, just with, I don't even necessarily care what they thought might have happened this offseason, but where you see this situation heading down the road?
Well, it's not good, and like I don't want to slam them for this either, because I didn't love the contract, but I didn't hate it either. And there is a little bit of hindsight 2020 here, because Ryan Anderson was not this Ryan Anderson, so I would be shocked if Ryan Anderson was getting these kinds of minutes if he was playing like he was playing last year. But as far as like the worst part about this is, there's that old adage that certain players would be played to showcase. they would, you know, you would play them like five games in a row and give them 30 minutes so that they could showcase their skills, so some other team might be willing to pick them up, seeing that they could still play. I still remember the wonderful game when Baron Davis had been injured all year on and off. And then suddenly he came in and he played a full like 36 minutes. He was obviously completely healthy, and so that night the trade to Golden State could happen, because Golden State needed to have that proven to them that Baron Davis wasn't actually injured.
And we needed Speedy Claxton.
We did, and was Dale Davis's expiring contract, I believe it was. And wasn't Jimmy Jackson part of that trade too? And he refused to report.
I have no clue.
I think he was too. Anyway,
that year, except for Dan Dicka.
Right. Anyways, how are we going to have if they decide, hey, Ryan Anderson is this player and he's going to be this player the rest of the year, and we can make do with the Jin, so we don't need to have a Sheik. How are you going to set move that contract if you're only giving him 10-15 minutes a game?
You make me happy and sad at the same time. It's happy because you basically outlined the main parts of the article I wrote today, but sad because I could tell you obviously didn't read my writing.
Because I didn't read it today. It's very true.
This is the exact same thing I said in the piece, and I pointed to the Nene Hilario of a couple years ago, where Denver had no plans of having Nene their long-term, but they didn't want to lose a player for quote-unquote nothing, so they re-signed him. And then a couple months later, they traded him for JaVale McGee, who helped for a little while, but we all know how that story ended. But the point was that their idea was that they were going to have it pay off down the line rather than just lose an asset for nothing, and I could see that being part of the logic, but Denver played Nene over those months a large amount of time so that he was actually coveted. You know, in my piece, I took a look at, you know, and I understand the whole argument of, well, Ashik's $10 million is really only going to be $6.5, $7 million when the cap jumps, especially in 2 years. And I get all that, but if you look at minutes and production right now, Ashik is on par, the three closest guys to him combined this year, their salaries aren't even $7 million combined. The 15 minutes and, you know, the average production he gives you is basically being filled around the league by guys on rookie contracts, minimum contracts, or slightly above minimum contracts. So who in their right mind is going to go out? Forget giving up an asset, because I don't think even the most optimistic person would say that the Pelicans could get an asset for Ashik. But who would even take Ashik for free on that contract when you could go out and get a guy who has produced similarly or plays that role either on a rookie contract or much cheaper? So that one, you know, the Ajinsa one, you could probably give away for free. Just because it's so small with where the cap's going. But, yeah, and hindsight is 2020, and I do get that. And, I mean, how much would we be bashing them right now if Ryan Anderson never did return to form and they let the big guys walk and then they had two Greg Steensma types, and we would probably be sitting here bitching about how we should have kept a Sheik and a Jensa. So I understand all of that, but it's just, to me, it's confusing as to how they expect to use them. And then again, the other thing I pointed out in my piece was a lot of the teams that you expect them to use those guys against, we haven't played yet. We haven't played the Clippers yet, who Ajinsa has historically been good against. We haven't played Houston and Memphis yet, the two teams with traditional centers in our division. We're going to get them eight times. We haven't played Sacramento yet. We haven't played Detroit yet. We haven't played the Nets yet. So a lot of teams who are still using those traditional centers, we haven't played yet. So the time still could come, but it's just, to me, it's impossible that we ever get the value out of those contracts. At this point, it's just about minimizing the damage and hoping that you know, they're not terrible contracts, but they'll never be great ones.
And one of the things that crossed my mind, and tell me if I'm so even when Ashiq has been on the floor, he set some really good screens, and I will say against Phoenix, I liked his hustle. Like, there's multiple times where he was hustling up down the court, would get near the rim, battle his way there, realize that he'd sprint out to set a pick and then sprint back to get into position. Like, maybe him only having to play 15 to 20 minutes a game at most is actually pretty good for his ability to do stuff. But overall, he hasn't, like, other than that game, there hasn't been really any moments where I've looked at Ashiq and said, he's doing really well for us. Like, last year there were moments where I was like, oh, he is really impacting this game. The way he's battling in there, the way he's doing that. Like, I had moments like this. I haven't had any. Part of it's because probably, like I said earlier, everybody's in the wrong roles right now and they're figuring it out. But is there a small chance, is there a small kernel of worry anywhere in you that Ashiq got paid and he doesn't care?
I don't think he's a money motivated guy. If you saw when he started acting like a baby a little bit in Houston, it was when his minutes and role was reduced. Right. So I'm saying that your theory might be possible, but not for the money reason, but for the, you know, the drastically reduced role reason. And Gentry hasn't, you know, walked on eggshells. He's come right out and said, yeah, in certain matchups, like against a team like Atlanta, we don't want to use those guys and we can't use them. And the thing I find really interesting is that teams could, you know, force us to play Ashiq or, you know, possibly damage us. The Knicks didn't put Robin Lopez on the floor. The Suns were more than happy to not play Tyson Chandler. So that's a little bit strange to me, is that, you know, you look at these games where Ashiq barely's playing, and then you say, well, you know, the other teams didn't put a center on the court either. I wonder if teams are going to adjust that way, where they're going to say, man, that AD Ryan Anderson combo is devastating, instead of trying to match up with them with what did Phoenix put out there? Markieff Morris and Teletovic?
Teletovic, right. Or whatever his name,
like,
is. Yeah.
You're really going to try to Teletovic. You're going to really try to match it. I wouldn't be surprised if Phoenix says, let's just put our best players on the court, which includes Tyson Chandler. And if the Pelicans want to stay small, you know, we'll beat them up in other ways. And then will that make Gentry put Ashiq out there? I'm curious to see if other teams do that moving forward, because I think that, you know, so far they've kind of been playing into our hands, even though we haven't had enough total weapons to beat them. But they're allowing us to play Ryan Anderson and Anthony Davis all those minutes, and I wonder if that changes moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty interesting, that game, because Ashiq played 15 minutes, Tyson Chandler played 16 minutes. And you could see that when Tyson Chandler left the court, that Ashiq left the court, except for one time where they shifted early, and then Tyson Chandler got in foul trouble, and then he never hit the floor again. And it was clear that Hornacek at that point was saying, okay, Tyson can't keep up with those dudes. He's having foul trouble. We'll keep him off the floor. And he never showed him again. Although there's still it's even deeper than that, because in particular, that Phoenix game, PJ Tucker was a hoss on Ryan Anderson. He made Ryan Anderson's life 87 times more difficult than it had been for, you know, the 2.5 quarters he was not facing PJ Tucker. That game made me love PJ Tucker even more than I did before.
Yeah, I've always been a huge fan. I'm really curious to see, though. I mean, a big reason why they were able to do that is because they were basically just able to put their worst player on Alonzo Gee. I wonder if you put Tyreek in that role. Like, you can't put I forgot, who was the other guy? Who did they put on Gee in that situation? I can't remember.
Most of the time, it was when he was playing, it was the rookie Booker and then Warren.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to be able to put those guys on Tyreek. So I think, again, that's something that could completely change the equation. So I'm still so hesitant to evaluate this Pelicans team, because I don't think we've seen anything close to who they're going to be. In addition to Tyreek coming back, it looks like probably to expect Cole and Quincy Pondexter sometime in the beginning of December. Jrue Holiday, apparently, his minutes restriction is going to go up. He should be somewhere at or around 30 in the next week or so. So
is that really a restriction at this point?
I mean,
like, does it really matter if he's going to play 30 or 33 minutes?
I mean, like, I think it kind of does, because
really,
don't you think that going into this Phoenix game, they ideally wanted to play Eric Gordon 33 minutes or so?
Yeah,
right?
Probably.
But when games are so close like that, you do whatever it takes to try to win it now, and then before you know it, he's up to 39, and the coaching staff is never, they're never once thinking about Eric Gordon's minutes and that. So just the fact that there is a restriction and the fact that you have to be conscious in it. I mean, we see them all the time now going, all right, we only going to play him 20 minutes prior to the last 5 minutes of the game because we want him down the stretch. So they're constantly, it's constantly something you're thinking about. So, you know, no, I guess in a vacuum, 33 minutes isn't a big deal. But when you get in a close game like that, all of a sudden, 33 minutes becomes 39, and that's not an option right now for Jrue Holiday. So I still think that there is something with that. But either way, it's going to be a different team in a couple of weeks, and an even more different team in a couple of months. But, you know, they got to get every win now, and that's what I'll ask you. On a couple podcasts ago, you said, if this team ever gets to a point where they're 10 games under 500, the season's over. Pelicans were 1-11 earlier in this week. I mean, do you think the season's over? And if not, what is your new bar for saying that they're just in too deep of a hole to be able to climb out?
No, I can't say the season's over, but I'm still really close to thinking that. Like, if they're 10 under and they're more like, I don't know, 17 games into the season, it's just like a quarter, almost a, not quite a quarter, but it's going to be really difficult because, like, I understand this team can, you know, the idea is always there, oh, they have to just run off quick 7 games, but that doesn't happen very often, and you always got to remember, like, when these Pelicans teams, when they were good, or the Hornets teams were good, they ran off those 9-game winning streaks. They then usually followed it by losing 6 of 9. So even if the Pelicans pull off those kinds of runs later in the season as the schedule gets a lot softer, they're still going to have moments where they collapse a little bit or don't have a great run, and they're not going to just maintain a easy 70% winning percentage or a 65% easy winning percentage. Because it happened so early and it was, you know, there's only 11 games when they went 1-10. And I believe the conversation was before was like 13-3 or 14-4 or something like that. I'm not quite ready to write them off, but I also have to bow to the reality. If you look at the standings right now, there's a lot of teams that haven't exactly performed incredibly well themselves that are easily within reach.
Yeah, and that's what I've been, the drum I've been beating for a couple weeks now is the West is not the West anymore. We have to get that out of our head that you're going to need 48. I don't even think you're going to need 45 wins to make the playoffs. I would put heavy money on it that at least one team with 43 or less wins is going to make the playoffs. I think we have to get past years out of our head and past thoughts of what the quote-unquote West is. And, yeah, I mean, there's 3 or 4 teams that are a lock. There's a bunch. I mean, Dallas is the fluke of all flukes right now. And, you know, eventually the things are going to start. You know, they'll get some injuries. The teams will start hitting against them. I think the Bird Rights put out a tweet today The teams are shooting 39% against us on contested threes and 29% against Dallas. I mean, stuff is going to even out over the system. Darren Williams is going to become Darren Williams made of glass again. Things are going to happen. I don't see many teams that, you know, I think are going to be that great. I've said, you know, the hardest part of the remaining schedule is these next couple of weeks. I think people are setting themselves up for a little disappointment by thinking that, you know, when Tyreek comes back, the wins are going to just compile because the schedule is really tough and it's still going to take them time to get into shape and other guys time to start getting used to playing with them again. But I think if they are 11-22 or better on January 1st, this team makes the playoffs. I think that's where they've got to be at that point, when the schedule gets incredibly easy and hopefully, you know, everybody's back by then and in shape and used to playing together. I of course would love to be a lot better, but I think that's basically what it takes and kind of the mini goal I'm setting for this team right now. 11-22 or better on January 1st, and I really like this team's chances to make the playoffs.
So, just math-wise, my feeling was this team, my ceiling of them coming into the season, not ceiling, but my general feeling of where they would be coming into the season would be somewhere around a winning percentage of about 60%, which means that a good pair of numbers to think of is you have to get 8 wins for every 5 losses that you have, which means you're gaining 3 every set of 13 games, which means your example of 11-22 puts them 33 games into the season. That leaves them with, what was that, 59 games left, 49 games left? I can't even do my math properly. 49 games left. If they pull off an 8-5 from that point on, every 13 games they win 8-5, they basically need a little more than 3 sets of that record to make up the difference, which is 39 games, which means they have an extra 10 games to spare to gather the last couple. So it's not inconceivable. If they can actually pull off the 8-5, which I was hoping for all along, that's plenty of time for them to catch back up and be a slightly better than 500 team.
Couple things. First of all, there are people at a gym right now who just watch somebody's head explode from them trying to keep up with what the hell you're talking about from a math perspective while they were running on the treadmill.
It's simple addition.
No, I know, but like you went all around the place. I pretty much followed you, but good God, man. The other thing is, so you were saying
these are what I think about when I'm steaming after a loss at 3 in the morning. Sorry.
All right. But yeah, and the other thing is you were talking about being a 60% win team over the course of 82 games. I don't think it's unrealistic to be much better than that in the easy part of your schedule. Like, we talk a lot about the Pelicans finishing 18-11 last year. They don't go 18-11 in many other stretches of that schedule with that lineup. Like, we got to all be honest. Go back and look at that schedule and the teams they were playing with the help they were playing
weak
at the time. That was really weak. You know, if you put that same exact Pelicans team against the schedule that they had faced beginning of the season, that same 29 games, they're probably 14-15 or 15-14. So while I agree that over the course of everything, 60% is probably, you know, the realistic percentage to look at, I think that post-January 1st schedule, combined with the fact that now it's going to be time for us to get the banged-up teams, for us to get the teams on the back-to-back. Like, as of a couple of days ago, we had played the most back-to-back games in the NBA. I think in January, we get the most teams playing us on the second night of a back-to-back of anybody in the league. So there's a lot of factors that start coming the Pelicans' way to where in that stretch of games, in those specific games, in those specific circumstances, again, fingers crossed with relatively decent health, I don't think 65, 66, even 67% is an insane benchmark for this team in that scope. Again, hopefully nobody's head has exploded for us talking too much math, but I tried to keep my thoughts as simple as possible. But I think that we could talk about raising the bar a little higher post-January 1st when you look at all the advantages we're set to have.
Okay. Let me, before we jump to what's coming up and do our preview, I wanted to just hit you with, like, give me, like, an 30 seconds, 45 seconds takes on some teams in the Western Conference, because it's like I said, you know, we can, you've been saying it's not, the Western Conference is not what it was. So I'm gonna give you a team and its current record, and you basically say, you know, call whether it's a mirage or what you expect from them the rest of the year. So, like, they're gonna continue to win at the same rate, or they're gonna be a lot better or a lot worse coming up, and it's just been some sort of fluke that's going on right now. Okay?
Ready.
First one, you kind of already said them, but Dallas Mavericks at 9-5.
One of the biggest flukes I've ever seen in my life. Like, wow. They are catching so many people at the right time. Like, they caught the Clippers at the right time in their game. They're, you know, they obviously caught us twice at the right time and somehow managed to lose to us once. But they're just catching so many people at the right time. Plus, you know, they have older guys who the season hasn't completely worn them down yet. They're playing 6:43 basketball right now. I'm still going to be surprised if they're over 500 at the end of the year when it's all said and done. I think they finish somewhere between 38 and 41 wins.
Okay. The opponent we just faced, the Phoenix Suns. They're currently 7-6.
Yeah, they actually lost tonight, 7-7. Eric Bledsoe did not play tonight with a sore left knee, so not that I root for injuries, but if they're already happened, I wouldn't mind if he sits out another game. When they started 7-5, 8 out of their 12 games were at home. As Mason detailed on Twitter, a lot of their wins were against very weak teams. So I think this is right around where they are if their two guards stay healthy. If one of them suffer a significant injury, which, you know, has happened to Bledsoe a couple of times in his career and with his playing style, I could see it being an issue. So I think they're right about where we see them now. They're a 500-ish team as well.
Okay. The Los Angeles Clippers at 6-7.
They're going to be significantly better. I still think this is one of the top four seeds in the Western Conference. But what I will say in talking about all these teams is, while we're sitting here like, well, playoffs are still a possibility even after our terrible start, part of me is so pissed that this team did not start off healthy, because this could easily be the second or third seed in the Western Conference right now.
Right.
The Pelicans are healthy starting this season. I mean, they could be well on their way to locking up home court advantage in the first. I could see them with the same record as the Spurs at 11-3. I could easily see that. And, you know, it's equally as frustrating as it is, has me optimistic, because I'm sure there's another team you're going to ask about here that's well below expectations as well. But while these other teams are all letting us in it and keep us hanging around, the other half of me goes, man, we really missed an opportunity with all those injuries, because we could be, you know, well on our way to a home playoff berth right now if we just had good health for the first time in 6 years.
Yeah. I won't ask you about the Grizzlies, because I know you already kind of thought they were heading this direction. So let's go instead with the Utah Jazz. Do you think they're a 500 team? They're 6-6 right now. They've got a plus 2.7 point differential, which is usually more indicative of a 46 or 47 win team, which is...
Yeah, they're down by 20 right now to OKC heading into the fourth quarter at home, I believe. This team is, I mean, we saw it when Rudy Gobert missed like two games. They weren't even competitive. If Gobert or Gordon Hayward miss games, this is a bottom, without one of those guys, this is a bottom five team in the NBA. Without both of those guys, they're a bottom two team. Like, they're terrible. They're mm-hmm. so dependent for different reasons on each of those guys that my gut tells me that law of averages, at least one of them, probably the big, goofy big man, gets hurt for a decent amount of time. And when that happens, they will lose games at the same rate as we're losing them right now. And that'll be the reason they finish below 500.
Okay. Now, there's probably been more podcast voices spilled. I don't know. over the Houston Rockets than any other team in the league. Like, you go listen to Zach Lowe. He has a whole podcast about him. The NBA lockdown. The sports guy. Everybody's talking about the Rockets. Do you buy that they're this much of a disaster right now and that they will continue to be?
Continue, no, but I think I was the first voice that compared this team to the Lakers when they added all those stars. And my point was that I hate when people say they added X player for nothing. You never add or lose a player for nothing. Ever. Ever, ever, ever. I don't care if you gave Denver nothing for Ty Lawson. You lost some of Patrick Beverley's minutes and faith and the continuity he has with the guys and the role he has on that team and the intangible. Like, you always lose something, even if it's not a tangible player. And I thought that was such a bad fit, and I never got it. And I said before the season I was much more afraid of this Houston team with Beverley than Lawson. So I think that unless they could find a way to get rid of him, or the more likely outcome, move him to the bench and go back to the Houston that they were before they acquired him and just let him be a spark plug off the bench, I think when they finally decide to do that, they will get better. But I thought there was a chance if everything went right, they could be a contender this year. I don't see any chance of that happening this year. And I also want to point out the rare player who devastated two franchises. Josh Smith's loss to that team and him going to the Clippers somehow negatively infected two contenders. So good on you.
Yeah. I do want to bring up one point just because I think this is really funny. I heard some guys on, I don't remember which podcast it was, but they were laughing it up about James Harden and his shooting percentage. And they're like, he's only like at 38% from the field and he's under 30% from three. He's terrible. And I just got to point out that even with, like, unbelievably abysmal shooting percentages, he is still scoring 1.362 points per shot. That is an amazing points per shot. There isn't a player on the Pelicans right now who can match that.
Yeah, no, I think... The more valid critique of him is kind of what David Thorpe talked about on Lowe's podcast of how you see him at the free throw line and nobody goes and gives him dap, how the you know, people don't tend to love playing with him, how, you know, he gets his assists but he's still not the team player in the, you know, the true sense of it, and there, you know, no leadership on there and all the things that we knew before, you know, the fact that he might be a coach killer now with McHale and what that leaves, the taste that leaves in the locker room. So think it's a lot of interesting factors, but I'm looking forward to playing that team. I mean, let me throw two more questions at you. Rajon Rondo, statistically, is playing like a man on fire. Cousins, we know, is elite. Do you think, right now, they're outside of it. Do you think at any point this year, national people are talking about Sacramento as a possible playoff contender?
So I will guarantee that at some point that will come up because they'll run off like a 4 or 5 game winning streak, which will put them, you know, 4 or 5 games probably below 500. And people will be like, they're finally pulling it together. They're going to make their move. And I also will guarantee that this team will suck for most of the year. And there is no chance in hell they're making the playoffs. No chance. Zero. Not making it. They're done.
My second question on this Western Conference is, we would all agree that we don't want the 8 seed and to play Golden State. Although I will go on record as right now, as I will call my shot in saying that they will be like the, I think it was 2008 Patriots. I know you don't watch much football, but that team went undefeated, had the greatest regular season of all time.
You think they're going to be defeated in the finals?
At some point in the playoffs, yep. I think that they will tie or break Chicago's regular season record and then lose in the playoffs.
You know, I will say that, if they do that, I'll be pretty surprised. If they manage to actually get that record, I'll be pretty shocked. Yeah. But I will say that, you know, taking the field against a team isn't really that brave of you. So right. I'm not impressed.
All right, calm down. I'm just saying that's just my gut feeling is I see a lot of parallels with that Patriots team. And that's what I get that feeling now. But the question I had for you is, take away Golden State. From what you've seen so far in the West, even if the Pelicans are the 7th seed, what team are you the second most afraid of in a playoff series if this Pelicans team is healthy and continuing to get better throughout the season? I mean, who would be that second team?
I'm going to go OKC.
Yeah, that's probably the same. Is there a third team? I mean, who would you rank third?
I mean, I think if the Clippers start firing on all cylinders, that they would be my third team. It would have been Houston. Like, something just about those Houston games when the Pelicans played them, they're so chaotic and so scattered. It always felt like the Pelicans were just going to have that one little choke for a couple of minutes where they couldn't hit shots, and Houston just rammed it down their throat, and suddenly they're down 10, and they weren't going to be able to really fight back against Houston. For some reason, that's what the Rockets games felt like. But now I'd say third is Clippers, but I don't know if they're ever going to be firing on all cylinders. So I'll stay with Clippers, but it's shaky Clippers. And the only reason why I'm staying is I don't have a four. Like, I'm not scared of the San Antonio Spurs. I'm not scared of them at all. And, you know, who's left? Phoenix? Eh. Memphis Grizzlies? No. Utah? No.
Yeah, I mean, that was the funny thing to me about San Antonio. Everybody talks about the Anthony Davis block and then throwing it off Aldridge. To me, the bigger thing in that play was that was what San Antonio thought was their best option. Like, it's not the San Antonio team from a couple years ago. Kawhi Leonard is amazing, but now they run offense through him. Now they run offense through LaMarcus Aldridge. This team was at its most dangerous when that ball was just flying around the perimeter and, you know, switching sides and driving kit, whatever. That team feels like it's gone, and I don't care how much pure talent they have. I feel like the Pelicans match up well, and I'm really not that afraid of that team. And it's not just because we beat them, but it's because I just think in general, you know, they have more talent, but they are not the Spurs team from 2 years ago.
Yeah, what we saw. So I can't even remember who said it anymore. but there was, I think it might have been Rick Adelman. I was listening to an interview of Rick Adelman, and they were talking about Isaiah Thomas and how amazing Isaiah Thomas was. And somebody said, like, people were surprised that Thomas had retired at, like, age, I think it was 31 or 32. And they're like, you know, why did he retire? So, like, those Detroit teams could have kept going because all the other guys on the team were decent age still. Like, Rodman was still young and Laimbeer was still pretty young. And, like, so they could have kept going. And Adelman said, well, you knew Isaiah was cooked because the year before, every game he had to turn his back to advance the ball up the court. He could no longer face up and advance the ball. If you put any pressure on him, he just didn't have the handles anymore. And that's immediately popped in my head when I was watching Tony Parker in that game, because Tony Douglas just met him at half court, and Parker had to dribble in the corner, warding off Douglas with one hand, and wait for a pass to open up that he could toss it to somebody else. He didn't have it. And got guards who are so reliant on speed and they're kind of small and they're not exceptional shooters tend to lose it right about at the age that Parker's at right now. So it's amazing how much he's just kind of become a non-entity. Like, were you at any point scared Tony Parker was going to take over that game at all?
No, but it was more because of the way they were used. I mean, the Parker Duncan pick and roll used to be my nightmare, but they just don't seem to use it that much. I think there's...
Can you at this point, though?
I don't know. I would need to see it more to know whether you can or not. I feel like, you know, they've gotten to the point where Kawhi is so talented that they've got to get him touches. And, you know, LaMarcus, obviously, they brought in, got to make him happy. I just think it's one of those situations that's possible in sports, but people don't recognize because they look at how things are on paper or in their fantasy lineups, and they think more talent equals a better team. And I've been very adamant about the fact that I do not think that Aldridge made San Antonio better one bit, and he had the potential to make them worse. And I still believe that way. I'm not really that scared of that team. I thought, even at the end of last year, that team was playing amazing, and I don't think they'll ever even reach that level again. Although I do think that their team in, say, 2017 or 18 will be better with LaMarcus Aldridge than if they had not made the signing. I never saw it as, you know, something where that put them in the championship conversation. So anyway, just, yeah, I wanted to see what you thought in general, but this is the Western Conference is not the Western Conference anymore. I just hope that finally sinks in for people. So let's move on to this week. I mean, speaking of the Western Conference, we got three Western Conference teams all on the road, 3 and 4 nights. As you said, it's the first one is a rematch with Phoenix. Then you got the Clippers. Then you got the Pelicans coming to Utah. Which of those games interest you for whatever reason?
Well, I already said I'm super interested in this next Phoenix game, but we just played them, so I don't think I'm going to really talk about them because everybody kind of saw what we're going to be up against. Although with Bledsoe out, I don't know if he's going to be back for this game. He's going to have, you know, a couple days of rest, so maybe he'll be back in time for it, and it'll be in Phoenix. And that is something to mention. This is a whole road trip this week: Phoenix, Los Angeles, and Utah. It's all on the road. The interesting team I want to talk about, I'm going to take the Utah Jazz because, you know what? I don't find Los Angeles that interesting anymore. There's too much writing about Los Angeles, so screw those guys. Let's talk about Utah, who nobody ever talks about. Their defense is just as stout as it was last year, except for, you're right, earlier in the season, Rudy Gobert did miss 2 games, and they looked completely mortal. Derek Favors was getting a lot of buzz is, oh, but don't forget Derek Favors, because you kind of look at that line and he's a good shot blocker too, and he's you know, usually the second leading scorer on the team, and he's a good rebounder, so he's got to be a really good player. But he's not an impact guy to me. Like, and it feels even stupid saying that right now, because you look at his stat line and he's a 16-9 with a PER of 25. He's very efficient. It just doesn't feel like at any point, you have to game plan around Derek Favors, that you have to figure out how you're going to counter that guy and how their offense uses him. And you do have to do that for players like Gordon Hayward. So then you don't have to say that about anybody else. Like Alec Burks, they paid him a bunch of money. He's okay. He's, you know, the less prolific version of Eric Gordon. Not very many rebounds, not very many assists, not very many steals, but he'll score some points as a slasher. And after that, I'm not scared of anybody on this team except for Jeff Withey. So who are you scared of on this team?
I'm scared of the fact that they don't allow teams to take many three-pointers. A big part of what they do is they play so far out on the perimeter and basically chase everything, and then they have Gobert sitting down low, so they just force most teams into a bevy of mid-range shots, and they're a lot like, and you called this comparison in our preview podcast for the season, they're a lot like the Indiana Pacers were a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of guys on this team who not only settle for the mid-range jumper, but seem to love it. So I fear that that kind of plays into Utah's hands. So I'm probably most fearful of their defensive coordinator. As far on the other end, I think Rodney Hood is shooting 28% from three. You know, this is going to be the random game where he goes off. Trevor Booker is going to find his stroke again. Raul Neto is all of a sudden going to be nothing but Neto.
That's so bad.
It's so bad it's good. You like it. So that, and the other thing I want to bring up is I was a big fan in the 80s of a movie called Over the Top. It was Sylvester Stallone as a professional arm wrestler.
Okay, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Oh, you better know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It's one of the best movies of all time.
I don't know if I'd say that, but okay.
Okay, top three. But what drove me crazy about it is for some reason nobody in the movie knew the last name of the main character. I've watched that movie, no exaggerating, probably 50 to 60 times.
Oh, God.
And at some points, his name is Lincoln Hawk, and the other points, his name, he calls himself Lincoln Hawks. And they can't seem to figure out which one it is. And that, every time I see this Utah team, it just bothers me because they have a Trey Burke and an Alex Burks. And it just brings back those memory. I challenge anybody to go watch Over the Top again. You will see him referred to as Lincoln Hawk sometime. And it's not like they say, oh, this is Lincoln Hawk's car, where they're using the plural possessive, I believe it is. It's just they purely mispronounce his name, and that's the other thing that bothers me about this Utah team is it brings back very frustrating memories of my childhood. So that's the other thing I've got to say on Utah. That's the other 2 cents I've got to chime in.
I'm still stunned that Over the Top is top three all time for you, because I'm sure you're 100% honest about that. I look at one of these teams and I'm looking for like the water bug point guard who's going to come off the bench and destroy us and make us all feel terrible. And I don't see it on this team. So obviously they're not a problem. We're going to destroy them. Let's move on. You want to talk about Clippers? Because I left them for you, unless you'd rather talk about the Suns.
Well, one thing, who do you think wins out the pace battle in this game? Because the Pels are going to want to play fast. Utah's dying to play slow. Which way do you think it leans more towards in this game?
Utah.
Okay. I don't want to talk about the Clippers. I want to talk about the thing that interests me this week, and that's we have Tyreek Evans coming back from an injury that was about 5 or 6 weeks, a surgery. I think it's pretty safe to say that we cannot expect him to be thrust into full-time minutes. What's also possible when a guy comes back in the first week of an injury is that you don't play him on a back-to-back. Now, we know Drew Holiday's on a restriction of a back-to-back. The Clippers-Utah game is a back-to-back situation. Let's say that the training staff advises not to play Tyreek in both games of a back-and-back, And now your head coach, Alvin Gentry. I know you're more Kevin Durant, but let's pretend you're Gentry.
That's right.
You have one of two decisions. Either one, you could play Holiday and Tyreek in the same game, or the second, you could stagger those two across the two games. Which tactic would you lean towards taking?
I think I'd play them both in the same game. And my thinking is we're in maintenance mode right now until everybody's back and ready to go. And what I mean by maintenance mode is if we could just keep playing 500 ball until people are ready to, like, everybody's back or we're starting, we get a little soft schedule and we can start tearing off wins. You just kind of want to win every other game. So rather than, and I don't even, it all depends on who the opponent is too, but rather than giving yourself, what, a 40 to 45% chance in two different games, why not give yourself a nice 70% chance in one game and a 25% or 20% chance in the other game? Maybe that math doesn't work out and probably is the exact same, and I'm sure Jason is yelling at me right now about something like that, but screw you, Jason. It feels better if you play both of them at the same time. I don't care what you have to say.
Yeah, I put this question out on a Twitter poll, and it was overwhelmingly, the opinion was that we should stagger them. And the interesting part was people had the same conclusion that you had, in that the point is to win as many games as possible, but they seem to think that staggering the two guys gave...
makes them likelier?
Yeah, like, and I don't know if I agree with that. And I think it's so negligible and so hard to predict whether, you know, you're going to win more games playing a 92 overall team in one game and an 80 in a second versus two 86 level teams. I think it's so negligible that the part that was the tiebreaker for me was, if and when this team is at its best, it's going to be Tyreek and Drew playing together. And these guys just haven't had enough time to play together, that every single chance that you give them to play together, learn each other, you know, build a relationship together, figure out how they want to play off each other, you've got to do it. So to where I couldn't really make a definitive argument that one would lead to more victories, I started looking for tiebreakers, and that was my tiebreaker. So I would agree, I would play both of them in the same game. Now the next question that's interesting is, okay, so do you play them together in the first game, the Clippers game, or do you sit them out that game and play them the next night at Utah?
No, I play them both on the first night. I'm still of the opinion that you don't try to be fancy about it and give yourself the better chance against the weaker team. I think you punch with everything you got the night you got it and send the message that we're not going to back down to anybody.
Yeah, and then, I mean, the Utah team has the inferior guard, so there's always a chance that Ish Smith and Tony Douglas could outplay Raul Neto and Trey Burke, or Burks if he was over the top too.
Trey Burke is a national champion, man.
Oh, I know. He's the next. No, they lost that game.
Did they lose that game?
Yeah, they lost.
Okay, he's not a national champion.
He's a national champion finalist.
That makes him a loser, so screw him.
Yeah, you can't get that far and have any winning qualities.
That's right. If you lose any games, you're a loser. It's the way things work.
Yeah, I mean, Charles Barkley never won a championship, so that's the only argument we need. So I think I would tend to agree, although I tend to think that Tyreek will be on a minutes restriction but not a back-to-back restriction, but I don't know. There's also the distinct possibility there's some swelling after the first game and they shut him down for another week. I mean, you just never know, but I was curious what you thought, if that was the situation, how you would play it, and surprised that we agree on that. I actually expected you to go the other way just because I felt like so many other people went the other way this week, but glad to see you and I are still on the same page somehow.
So
prediction time.
Before we get to your game, I do want to bring up two things from the Phoenix game that I wanted you to hear in all their glory. I kind of said, told you about this before we started the podcast, but for those of you who got the joy of listening to League Pass and the Phoenix team's announcers, you'll know what I'm talking about. I don't remember who they had last year. I don't remember the names. For some reason, Phoenix never really stuck in my mind as really bad announcers, so it kind of surprised me at how bad the announcer was for Phoenix. But here are some very important things you should know about the Pelicans, because this is what the color commentator said for Phoenix, and he's got to be right because he watches basketball. So first off, Anthony Davis, he takes way too many damn three-point shots.
Mm.
Way too many. It's ruining his game, and that's why his field goal percentage is so low. I thought you should know that. And Eric Gordon is one of the best scorers around the rim in the NBA today.
Mm. God, I want that one to be so true.
I was listening to this guy, and he was like that all game. Oh, sorry. I wanted to get that out there because they were so bad. Like the color guy there has never watched any team other than his own. And he apparently thinks that Eric Bledsoe is the best guard in the game, which is pretty funny considering what's happening in Golden State.
You ever tend to think about you and I as color, as like commentators for a game? Like these,
I would be terrible at it.
I hear these guys, and they've got to be, like, so optimistic and keep things going.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whether you call it being truthful or being negative, whatever you call it, I mean, we would just bring the darkness to some games.
Ish-Smith.
Yeah.
He's got the ball again. He is not a legitimate starting point guard. Not going to end well.
This game's over. Why are they even playing? Like, yeah, I mean, it would be darkness at times. We'd probably be, who was it that DeMarcus Cousins like wanted to choke out Sean Elliott? Like that would happen to us every game.
I gotta say I might be a little bit on DeMarcus Cousins' side there because Sean Elliott.
Let's
get distracted away from the hate.
Yeah, no, I agree, but that's why I will always say get ball streams over League Pass because I get to pick which announced team I want to listen to, and I always pick the Pelicans one. Before we get to the game, which I'm really excited about this week, predictions for the week. Three games, all on the road, Tyreek possibly being back. What do you got?
I'm gonna go optimistic and a 2-1 week.
Yeah, I'm gonna swing the other way. I mean, tough games. This Pelicans team, they have looked good at home this year. I have yet to see a game. I mean, what would you say is the best game they played on the road this year? Probably that OKC game.
Oh yeah, definitely. Not any question.
So, and I would say there was even some really bad parts there. So. I would say that I have yet to see enough from this team on the road to put faith that they're going to win 2 out of 3 against at least solid road teams. So I'm going to go 1-2.
Okay.
All right. So what I wanted to do this week, I was kind of inspired. I thought it was interesting. So we are going to play a game called Advertising Slogan or Rap Lyric. And basically what this is I will tell you the industry, and I will give you a couple of slogans, but one of them is actually a rap lyric to an iconic song.
Okay.
You will have to tell me which of these is the rap lyric.
Okay.
So the first line of
this is pretty clever. I'm liking this.
So
one.
the first business industry is bakeries.
Okay.
So one of these is a rap lyric. The other of them are all slogans for bakeries around the world. All right, you tell me which one is the rap slogan. So first one is, we create it, make it, and bake it. feeding the multitudes. Everybody, get your roll on, or make it more-ish. Again, I'll give you. So A is, we create it, make it, and bake it. B, feeding the multitudes. C, everybody, get your roll on. D, make it more-ish.
All right, for some reason, I think C is in there to trap me into picking it. So I'm going to go with D.
Make it more-ish?
Yeah, that's the rap lyric.
That is actually Mortimer's Bakery.
Okay.
Your instinct was right. Everybody get your roll on is big. It's the big timers.
Ah.
Yes. Everybody gets your roll on. Everybody gets your mother effing roll on. So that's it. This is all, this is the next category is technology.
Okay.
So you're very familiar with technology and the waves. Okay.
I'm all hip with that.
So it's either a slogan or a rap song. So we've got "Your challenge is our progress. Don't let them hold you down. Reach for the stars. You push the limits, we measure it." And D is "the way it's meant to be played." So again, A,
wow.
A, your challenge is our progress. B, don't let them hold you down, reach for the stars. C, you push the limits, we measure it. D, the way it's meant to be played. Three of them are technology companies. One is a rock lyric.
I think B just sounds too uplifting of a sentiment to be in a rap. So I gotta say B is definitely not the rap.
Okay.
And something about measuring it makes me think about big dicks, and rappers are always singing about that. So I'm going with that, C.
So you're going with "you push the limits, we measure it," because rappers are always talking about big dicks.
Yes, that's right.
Actually, you are incorrect.
Oh, no.
"Don't let them hold you down, reach for the stars" is part of the chorus of Notorious B.I.G.'s huge breakout song, Juicy.
Come on.
Your chat.
That sounds like sort of like Broadway musical or something.
It's a beautiful song. You should listen to it. Puff Daddy actually made the band recite it, and when they couldn't, they had to go pick him up cheesecake. They had to walk to Brooklyn, I think it was, somewhere, and pick him up cheesecake. So there's another trivia for your rep game. But your challenge is our progress is IF Engineering Corp. You push the limits, we measure it is RCAT Systems. The way it's meant to be played is NVIDIA.
Yeah.
So... all right, this is the last one. This all has to do with railroad train companies. Okay? You tell me which one is a train railroad slogan and which one is the rap lyric. So, A, this is the age of the train. B, come on, ride the train, ride it. C, let the train take the strain. Or D, inner city makes the going easy and the coming back. So again.
Those are all awesome.
A.
I think the only one I'm like dismissing out of hand is A.
Okay, so A, this is the age of the train.
Yeah,
B,
I'm leaving that one out.
Come on, ride the train. Ride it. C, let the train take the strain. D, inner city makes the going easy and the coming back.
I'm going to dismiss D as well. I think it's between B and C here. And although C is phenomenal as any sort of lyric, especially if you're referring to yourself as the train, I'm going to go with B because I don't know why you would repeat yourself unless you're doing some sort of lyric. So I'm going B, that's the rap lyric.
You are correct. One of
the
Quad City DJs, come on, ride the train and ride it. Come on, ride the train, ride it. Quad City DJs, Time to Ride That Train. Yeah, that is a rap song from the 90s. You would be shocked to know that they were one-hit wonders. British Rail actually had two of these slogans. They had some amazing slogans, but let the train take the strain. I agree.
That would be a phenomenal lyric.
Yeah.
I really like that one.
Yeah.
You gotta drop the beat.
Well, I'll let you come up with a verse based around that lyric itself. We could have it for us on the next pod. But yeah, so that was a game. Play it with your friends. Rap lyric or advertising slogan.
I got 2 out of 3. I'm pretty stoked.
You got 1 out of 3, but as we've already established on this pod, your math isn't great, so. Which other one do you think you got right?
Didn't I get another one right? I thought I got another one right.
No. 1 for 3, but whatever. In baseball, that's still a great average.
That's right. I'd be a phenomenal baseball player.
Or if that was Alonzo Gee's 3-point percentage, we would be in heaven.
Yes, it's true. All right, so you got anything else?
No. That's about it. Looking forward to an enjoyable week. We'll all get to see Tyreek hopefully again, and this team is getting mm-hmm. closer and closer to what we expected it to be.
Yep, and with Tyreek Evans coming, we're going to get all the wins.
All of them.
So thanks for listening to In the Know, and we'll be back next week.